Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm John Batchelor. It is 1849. Queen Victoria, a trip to Ireland. After the catastrophe of what something is called a famine, the Great Famine of Ireland. And what we know in America of it is something happened to the potatoes that made it impossible for the Irish to feed their children and themselves for several years. And those that survived fled to America. That's what we know. But I welcome somebody to tell us the rest of the story, the backstory of those fleeing farmers and peasants and young people who came to New York and then fanned out and are the backbone of the voting public of the United States. I welcome Padraig Scanlon, an associate professor at the University of Toronto's Center for Industrial Relations and Human Resources. His new book is Rot, an Imperial History of the Irish Famine. I begin in 1849 because this is a ghost story. This did not happen, but it was told about Victoria and about a village in County Cork called Skibbereen. Padraig, a wonderful good evening to you. Congratulations. I did not know what I did not know until I read your book. What was the ghost story told of Queen Victoria? Where was Skibbereen in the story? Good evening to you.
Well, thanks very much for the invitation. So Victoria did visit. So this was in the midst of the Great Irish Famine, a nearly half decade long crisis in Ireland caused by the repeated failure of Irish potato crops, leading to initially food insecurity and later to profound starvation conditions across a lot of, although not necessarily all of Ireland. And near the end of the famine, Queen Victoria did, in fact, visit Ireland. But in folk memory, Queen Victoria is remembered as arriving in Ireland in 1847 rather than in... She in fact, did visit Ireland near the end of the famine in 1849. But in 1847, which was one of the bleakest years of the crisis, there are folk stories about Queen Victoria stepping off of the royal yacht in Ireland and then seeing sort of words appear on a stone, arise ye dead from Skibbereen and come to Cork to welcome your queen. So Skibbereen was a village in Cork, is a village. I mean, it's still a settlement in Cork in Ireland, in the south of Ireland. That was the site of one of the kind of most dramatic and most highly publicized moments in the famine, when a journalist visited Skibbereen in 1847 and saw this scene of sort of unbelievable, like bleak depravity of bodies lying in the streets and a woman who had just given birth, kind of just still covered in blood, just a scene of complete kind of social collapse. And so Skibbereen became this icon of the Irish famine. And in folk memory, right, it's this moment when Queen Victoria steps off her boat and is suddenly confronted by the ghosts of the Irish famine. And so it's, I think a good place to start thinking about and talking about the history of the famine.
How we got to here. Cummins was the man, the journalist. And at one point, he reports a young woman crawled out of a house where she'd been living or existing as she starved to death with her mother and father and relatives who she was too weak to move. So yeah. She watched them being infested by the rats and the insects for days before Cummins came in and she crawled out and begged him for help. And that woman who gave birth, she grabbed it at Cummins and he fled.
That's right.
He came back with police the next day, and they found bodies everywhere.
That's right.
They starved to death in their in their houses. Well, you can call them a house, what was left of them. How did we get to this? And it begins with an understanding of Irish agriculture here in the 19th century. 19th century. This is the British Empire. This isn't ancient history. It's potato, yes, but Patraic introduces us to the three legs of the stool that was, in good years, sustaining those people in Skibbereen and everyone else. The three legs of the stool, the potato, sure, the pig, and the ecosystem itself, the turf. How did it work, Patraic?
Right. So I think it's worth, understanding briefly just the role that potatoes played in Irish agriculture, because the potato was a kind of glue that held together a system that was fairly productive, right? I mean, from 1801, Ireland was no longer, in the 18th century, Ireland was a kind of subordinate sister kingdom to Great Britain. But from 1801, Ireland was a part of the United Kingdom. And so Ireland was not just a part of the British Empire, but part of the British state itself, with representation in Parliament, with representation in the Lords, with the same currency, without trade barriers between the islands. And Ireland provided a really substantial portion of the imported food, especially beef and pork and oats, that British consumers were able to buy, right? So Ireland was an agricultural exporting economy. But Ireland was also one of the places in the British Empire with the lowest agricultural wages for laborers, right? It was an extraordinarily capital poor island, and it was also a place where a lot of people lived on very little money. And into the breach stepped the potato, right? The potato, this crop that had first crossed the Atlantic in the wake of the Spanish and Portuguese conquistadors of the 16th century, right? It's an American crop that was imported from the Americas back to Europe, and across Western Europe became this backstop that many poor farmers and agricultural workers across Western Europe relied on in times of crisis, in times when other crops failed, in times of war, right? There were a lot of peasants in Germany who survived the 30 Years' War in part because they were able to hide potatoes in the ground when marauding armies crossed, you know, Catholic and Protestant armies crossed Germany. In Ireland, though, this backstop crop became the staple and then a kind of hyper staple for Irish agricultural laborers for reasons that we can explore maybe in a few minutes. But on the eve of the famine, right, the potato in concert with the pig and, as you say, with peat moss, with turf, flammable, virtually free fuel, that still carpets a lot of the Irish countryside. A lot of Ireland is still bog. Formed this very fragile, but in good years, fairly, I don't want to say robust, having just said it's fragile, but this kind of, in good years, these kind of three elements together could keep people alive. So the potato's value was that it was, could produce enormous yields, right? So potatoes even now are grown not from seeds, usually. They're grown from cuttings. So if you want to grow a potato yourself, right, you can take a potato, cut out the eyes into sizable chunks, and then bury the chunks of the tuber. And provided those seed cuttings are not eaten by pests or killed by a pathogen, you can get a fairly large yield of potatoes very quickly. And in the 18th century and the early 19th century, those yields were even bigger. And so potatoes were inexpensive and produced really huge quantities of food on relatively small parcels of land with relatively little, comparatively speaking, with relatively little maintenance. So for Irish laborers, who were earning very low wages, for taking care of flocks, or for caring for cattle, or for growing oats, they became a way of, they became a means through which, landlords could pay very low wages, while simultaneously not worrying about their workforce starving to death. And so the potato and its abundance became a kind of glue that held together Irish rural society, and especially the rural society of farm laborers. So the kind of poor, the very poor and the landless within Irish society. And it's worth noting, right, Ireland is the only place in Western Europe now that has fewer people in 2026 than it had in 1846 or 1845, right? Ireland is substantially a less populated country than it was in that era. So on the eve of the Irish famine, there were about 9 million people, just under 9 million people living in Ireland. And about 2 million of those people survived exclusively on potatoes.
Let us discuss how Ireland was divided up by the English crown. It's not a natural emergence of governance. It's the colonial masters. It's the conquerors who developed Ireland into the poor rural basis of the famine. So when we come back, Oliver Cromwell and the conquest of Ireland. Patrick Scanlon is the author. Rot is the book. I'm John Batchelor, Professor Patrick Scanlon, Associate Professor at the University of Toronto. His new book is Rot, An Imperial History of the Famine, the Great Famine of the late 40s into the 50s in Ireland that drove so many Irish to America, and good for us. However, I come to, how did Ireland come to be cut up and owned by the English? Where did this come from? Well, it starts with James I and his son Charles I, who has his head cut off by Parliament, and Oliver Cromwell, the great protector, who leads an army into Ireland and massacres and storms and seizes and conquers. And then, in reward for helping Cromwell cut up Ireland and persecute the Catholics, he hands out land to men who fought with him. And Patrick offers one example that helps. What was Shirley Castle? Where did that come from? What did it look like? What was its place in the economy?
Sure. I mean, Shirley Castle is Shirley Castle is a castle in Monaghan, in Ireland. I think it still stands. I think it's a hotel now, if you want to visit, with a golf course attached. But it's in Monaghan in southern Ulster. And the Shirley family, who owned the castle and owned the land surrounding it, on the eve of the famine, owned about a tenth of the whole county of Monaghan. And they were the descendants of Walter Devereux, the first Earl of Essex, who had been deeded the land even before Cromwell, in fact, right? Who had been given the land during the reign of Elizabeth I as a reward for his participation in the early campaigns to install a new English-led or anglicizing colony in what's now the north of Ireland, right? In what's now still part of the United Kingdom, the Ulster Plantation. And so the Shirleys owned this land, and they, you know, on the eve of the famine, they were by the standards of Irish landlordism, they were not particularly neither good nor bad, really. They were, which means they were probably not like, they weren't notorious landlords, but they weren't at the same time landlords who were considered to be particularly friendly to their tenants. And Shirley Castle was a building that the Shirleys had put up. I forget exactly when they broke ground, in the early 19th century, I think, that was designed to kind of evoke an ancient Irish past, right? It was this faux Tudor castle. It was decorated with artifacts of the family history inside. They had some Spanish great masters hanging on the walls. It was this sort of very deliberately anachronistic looking building. And that was really one of the features of the Irish landscape, right? It was this landscape that looked ancient, right? It was still farmed principally by a large number of tenant farmers and sometimes landless farmers and laborers who were mostly growing potatoes, which they were either eating themselves or feeding to pigs that they then would sell once a year to make rent, and they were burning turf, right? This was a very low technology, low capital, low wage economy. And it looked old, right? It looked ancient. And Shirley Castle evoked that. It was meant to look like something from the 16th century. But one of the things I think that's important to understand about the history of the Irish famine, and one of the themes that I emphasize in Rot, is that those appearances can be deceiving, right? The Irish countryside looked old, but in fact, Ireland was quite closely connected to global markets. It was quite closely connected to British markets. And the Shirleys were not kind of old-fashioned medieval landlords. They were quite sophisticated, very modern merchants, right? They sold agricultural products. They collected rent. They employed a staff of professional managers and land agents to collect rent on their behalf. And so I take in the book Shirley Castle as an emblem both of the kind of anachronistic aesthetics of Ireland, but also its very real economic modernity in the early 19th century. And that disjuncture is really important to the book, and I think it's really important to understanding the famine.
The Victorian era. Here's the facts of who owned the land in the Victorian era. 4,000 people owned 80% of Ireland. 2,000 owned 93% of Scotland. 5,000 owned more than half of England. 60% owned Wales. 60% of Wales was owned by a few thousand people. So what we had was a forced enslavement of the people who lived on the land. They had no choice. And Patrick, we're going to spend some time talking about corn acres and subletters and dividing the land up, because that is the backstory for the famine. And the famine is the backstory for the Irish migrants of the late 19th, early 20th century.
I wanted
to emphasize that nobody asked, nobody in Ireland voted for 4,000 people to own all that land. Nobody invited Devereux and the Shirleys into County Cork or their county that they came in. They were there by conquest. Do I say that correctly, Professor?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true, right? I mean, I think it's also hard to say. I mean, like, it's worth noting, right, that the United Kingdom, I mean, this is the United Kingdom in the first half of the 19th century had a larger electorate than it had in the 18th century. But to call the United Kingdom a democracy would miss, you know, some important realities about how the country was governed, right? It's an oligarch. In many ways, the UK is an oligarchy dominated by aristocrats whose wealth flows from land, and a small, but in the 19th century, growing group of industrialists and merchants whose income comes from buying, making, and selling things.
The famine, Professor. We'll go right to it as you explicate. The book is Rot, an Imperial History of the Great Famine, Irish Famine, and Black 47 is the worst of it, but it begins throughout the century. I'm John Batchelor, spending time with Professor Patrick Scanlon. His new book is Rot, an Imperial History of the Great Irish Famine. The observation that people were starving did not come in just between 1845 and 50. There had been failures of crops many times in the early part of the 19th century, and that's the important area we're looking at, the 19th century, after the Union Act brought members of Parliament and members of the House of Lords in from Ireland. And so theoretically, they were participating in their own governance. There's a quote in Patrick's book that helps understand the Victorian opinion of the poor farmers of Ireland who struggled on land that was taken from Ireland a century, two centuries before. After Elizabeth's time, after James I's time, after Charles I's time, during the time of Cromwell, Lord Protector, and then the Restoration, the English kept the land. They didn't ask the Irish permission. And Thomas Robert Malthus, who's an economist of the Victorian era, he explained the famine and what was going on when the Irish were starving. They were starving often. They were always at the edge of starvation. Even the well-to-do peasant had to watch his crop and balance off, do I sell the pigs? Do I sell the cow? Do I sell the potatoes? What will the price be? You had to do arbitrage all the time. Malthus argues, I'm reading from Patrick's book, a civilized and well-governed society would not choose to feed the poor, since without the check of hunger, the poor would not work, but would reproduce, making a subsistence crisis inevitable. Nature in such a crisis would restore the balance between population and food supply through, quote, famine, the last, the most dreadful resource of nature. That is the opinion of a Victorian economist, and I believe, Patrick, it's fair to say that that was uniformly practiced. The idea if they're not going to starve, they won't work for us. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to, I think the association between and the preoccupation with work ethic and with steady work is something that exercised a lot of Victorian policymakers and political economists, or they would have called themselves at the time, right? And so one of the big questions for the British Empire, especially in relationship to the many peoples outside of Britain proper, and indeed quite a lot of people in Britain who were considered to be insufficiently civilized to maintain the kind of work ethic of the Victorian middle class, right? The question was, how do you get people to work, right? And that was a question that animated British policy at the abolition of slavery in the British Caribbean in 1833, right? The first question for British policymakers after abolition was how to get formerly enslaved laborers to continue to work on sugar plantations, despite the long very low wages that were going to be offered on sugar plantations, and also the centuries long association between sugar plantations and mass enslavement. So that was a question for the abolitionists. In British cities, the question was, how can the urban poor be not compelled to work, right? And that's I think that's one of the kind of fault lines in Victorian thinking about labor and Victorian thinking about this really amorphous concept of civilization, is how can you get people to want freely to choose to work for low wages for long hours and save their money in a way that is consistent with the expectations of the Victorian middle class, right? And for people like Malthus, Malthus was interested in population above all, right? We still think about Malthus in terms of in a sociology class or a demography class, what they call a Malthusian crisis, right? Malthus hypothesized in his book, Essay on the Principle of Population, that food production would inevitably be outstripped by population growth, because population growth grows exponentially, whereas food production at best grows geometrically. And so at some point, right, those two curves, that kind of straight line of gradually increasing food production and that really rapidly increasing line of population growth, eventually the one would cross the other, and then you would have some sort of crisis. And so for Malthus, I mean, I think Malthus didn't welcome starvation, and I mean, he was sort of indifferent to it, but he didn't welcome it as much as he judged it to be inevitable, right? And so the consequences of providing people who are incapable, in his view, of limiting population on their own, would then be subject to the much heavier, much more brutal forces of nature. So that's what Malthus means when he says that famine is the last most dreadful resource of nature. So Malthus was interested in examining what made populations around the world increase dramatically, and what made them remain static. And for him, the object of government was not to provide anything to the poor who might then take those gifts, I guess, or those resources from the state and use them imprudently to increase their numbers, but rather to figure out what sorts of social policies work naturally And the idea of what is natural and what isn't natural is really important to the Victorians. What conditions could be created such that people would voluntarily restrict population growth? And so for Malthus, right, in Ireland, Malthus hypothesized, and he wrote very little about Ireland, which is interesting, considering that Ireland was, you know, the growing population of Ireland was a real obsession for early 19th century Britons. But Malthus wrote a couple, I think a single, in the end, unsigned essay that I quote in the book. And Malthus imagined that Ireland's population would reach 20 million people by the end of the 19th century. And for him, the problem, one of the reasons why that was possible and one of the kind of profound hazards of that fact was that the potato was just too generous in Malthus's view. It was too easy to grow. And it provided too much food with too little input of labor. And consequently, it was a means through which the Irish poor could reproduce without any of the kinds of disciplinary and ostensibly civilizational checks on their population that operated in other societies. So Malthus is a rich brew, right? He's thinking about food supplies. He's thinking about population growth. He's also thinking about the kinds of stimuli that change or don't change the behavior of people who the British Empire would judge to be less civilized than middle-class Britons. So there's an awful lot going on in Malthusian thought, and it's telling, right? Because Malthus was among the most influential political economists of the first half of the 19th century in Britain.
This is an island of landlords. We've talked about the Shirley Castle, the Faw Castle, but the landlords would use jobbers, debt collectors, to work for them, and they would rent out pieces of land for rent. And if you didn't make your rent, you were either evicted or in some way you had your livestock confiscated. We need to do some definitions here, Patrick. What is a conacre? What did it mean?
Yeah, conacre is a kind of leasehold that was very common in Ireland, and I think still exists in some parts of Ireland, although it's now very, you know, obviously been modified a lot over time. It's a kind of lease that is renewed every year, and it doesn't span a full 12 months. So it's usually 10 or 11 months, depending on the region. It's priced relatively high. I mean, it's not priced very high for the standards of rents of land in England, for example, but for Ireland, it's quite expensive. And it's very small. So it's land rented for, a quarter acre to an acre of land rented for 10 or 11 months. On an annual basis, it usually is rented pre-manured, and it's designed for growing potatoes
and soil only, right, Professor? Soil that, only.
That's right. All Irish land is rented what's called soil in this area. What's called soil only, which means that the land that any improvements that a tenant makes to the land can then be folded into their rent the next time they renew. So in England, right, where generally people who are known as farmers in this era, right, farmers in England, when you hear farmer in 19th century England, don't think necessarily poor agricultural labor. Think somebody with a fair amount of money who's renting a pretty large chunk of land and often is engaged in some kind of partnership with a much wealthier aristocratic landlord to improve the land in some way through irrigation or through road building or canal building. And in that case, right, if a tenant farmer in England invests £5,000 in building a canal, making it easier to bring their food, the food they produce on their farm to market, then that cost is shared with the landlord, or the landlord makes a cut in rent, or they have some kind of business relationship to each other that makes it such that the rent doesn't go up because the tenant has improved the land. But in Ireland, where land is rented soil only, if a tenant improves the land, then the next year the rent could go up. But conacre is rented soil only, but conacre land was very rarely improved in any way. It was very small parcels of land rented to relatively and sometimes very poor people in order to grow potatoes and survive from year to year, wages notwithstanding.
And you have one anecdote where a man won't even whitewash his own house because he'd think that the jobber, the debt collector, would see it from the road and charge him more, say, I'm not charging him enough.
Yeah, exactly, right? It's a tenant tells a visitor walking through rural Ireland sees this is talking to a cottager, and the cottager says, like is being asked, like, why don't you paint your cottage? It's falling into disrepair. It's gone to seed. And he replies, right, that the landlord's agent might see a prettily whitewashed cottage from his horse and think, hey, this cottage has been undervalued. Let's raise the rent. And so that feature, that feature of the Irish economy is really telling because it shows the way that, Ireland is integrated into the economy of the United Kingdom, but it is systematically at a disadvantage. And the kind of forces that are impelling the United Kingdom to greater and greater wealth and productivity and prosperity in the 19th century are at the same time they're pulling Ireland apart, right? So what is the kind of economic vitality that is accelerating in the United Kingdom is having a paradoxical and kind of opposite effect in Ireland and kind of pulling the Irish economy apart at the seams.
Let's go to the blight. Patrick Scanlon is the author. Rot, an Imperial History of the Great Irish Famine is the book. I'm John Batchelor with Professor Scanlon. You plant on St. Patrick's Day and you harvest in November, perhaps. That's the agricultural calendar. However, the blight comes. It comes from a seed shipment from the Americas back to Europe. And it isn't understood. They're not ignorant of how crops grow. They don't have the language that we use today. But they do see it strike. And when it does strike, it spreads from country to country, and it comes to Ireland in the early 1840s. But they'd had famine scares before and failures of crops. This was different, correct, Professor?
That's right. Yeah, so yes, so the Irish potato crop. So one of the features of potatoes, as I mentioned earlier in our conversation, is that they're usually grown from cuttings rather than from seed. And that means that in good years, they can produce really startling and impressive yields. But it also means that every potato grown from a cutting is a clone of the potato that it was cut from. And that lack of genetic diversity in potato crops makes them especially vulnerable to pests and especially vulnerable to pathogens. And so Ireland and potatoes, are fairly hardy, but they can still be killed in the ground by adverse weather or too much rain or too little rain. And so Ireland depended on potatoes long before the Great Famine began in 1845, and the Irish potato crop failed many times, both before and after Ireland was integrated into the United Kingdom in 1801. But it never failed. Those failures were less complete, and they were also often local. So, for example, poor weather in the southwest of Ireland might harm southwestern Irish potato crops, leading to localized famine or localized subsistence crisis before the Great Famine. But as you say, the Great Famine was caused not by weather or by a sort of epidemic of an already circulating virus or other pathogen of potatoes. It was caused by a novel pathogen, which plant geneticists have now identified or believe that they've identified as originating in the central valleys of Mexico, where potatoes grow wild, and where wild potatoes are in a more kind of secure ecological balance with the pathogen with plant pathogens. And that broke out of central Mexico to South America, probably to Peru, and then it circulated from where potatoes also grow wild and circulated from Peru to North America, where it struck potato crops in Canada and in the United States in 1843, and then eventually crossed the Atlantic. This organism called Phythophthora infestans or P. infestans, which arrived in European potato fields in 1844 and 1845, and caused devastation everywhere it struck, right? This was a novel pathogen that suddenly encountered fields of potatoes that had been separated from from this kind of pathogen for a few hundred years, that were being grown in huge monocrops in tightly, you know, in fields that were very close together, allowing it very, which made it very easy for this pathogen, which is a what's called a water mold, which is something like a fungus. It's related to, but not literally a fungus. It reproduces in the same way as fungi do, which is through sporulation. So spores from blighted potatoes could easily pass on the wind to the next field over. Field potatoes were really close together. And, you know, this organism swept across everywhere potatoes were grown, and destroyed potato fields everywhere it went. But there were other parts of Europe that depended on potatoes a great deal, places like Belgium, places like the Netherlands, parts of southern Prussia, Poland, but nowhere other than Ireland was dependence on potatoes so profound, and were there so few other options for feeding the very poor and the people who depended on potatoes. So it was really in Ireland where this epidemic of potato disease snowballed into a catastrophe. But everywhere this organism struck, potatoes died.
And it struck not only the potatoes growing on the tubes, but also the potatoes they'd stored for their hungry summer. The summer was the hungry time, not the winter time. So when they dug their potato pits up, they were rotten. You described the fact that they gave an odor off as if they were rotting human flesh.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know for a fact. I mean, that might have been something evocative that people, I mean, people describe there being a very distinctive kind of rotting smell from these fields. And as you say, yeah, the P. infestans has this feature which was unique to other, which was set it apart from other threats to potatoes in that it could strike potatoes in the ground that had been stored, that had already been sort of harvested and stored, as well as potatoes that were still growing. So, you know, in previous potato failures, if there was a failure due to heavy rain, potatoes that had already been harvested were fine, and potatoes in places that were less hard hit by rain were also fine. But in 1845 and 46 and 47 and 48, as P. infestans, these kind of waves of this epidemic struck Irish potatoes, that wasn't the case. And so laborers and farmers who had grown potatoes for subsistence found that not only the potatoes in the ground, but also the potatoes that they had stored for the future had been destroyed, which made the crisis even worse, because it meant that there was kind of no buffer, nothing to cushion the calamity of having lost a crop in the ground.
Now we turn to the government, because the government's answer also becomes a major part of the problem. The book is Rot, an Imperial History of the Great Irish Famine. Patrick Scanlon is the author. I'm John Batchelor.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.